Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the Health and Human Services Finance Division. We do have a quorum present, and we're ready to get started with House File 840. Representative Lee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lean. And I understand this is a bill that we heard last year, but didn't make it through. And it's got a new fiscal note, I understand. So, Representative Lean, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Oh, and Representative Lean, sorry, since you're not on the committee, I have to move your bill. So the chair will move House File 840 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a Health and Human Services budget bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And can I also ask you to move the A2 amendment right away?
Yes. So the chair moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the order in which the author would like it discussed. And as I see, this only changes the effective date.
That is correct.
So there shouldn't be any real discussion needed. So on the amendment, all those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now go ahead, Representative Lee.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks again, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate your time and attention on this bill again this year. And I am presenting again on House File 840. And this bill will add periodontal coverage back to the list of covered services for medical assistance dental. There are two common diseases of the mouth, tooth decay and periodontal or gum disease. Coverage of periodontal disease was eliminated in 2009 when the state was suffering from a budget deficit in the billions. That year, half of all adult dental benefits were eliminated. Today, other states are adding adult dental benefits because oral health and overall health are linked. Periodontal disease is left untreated. It can lead to more expensive treatment for other health problems, as well as to hospitalizations. Sometimes gum disease treatment is required before a patient can undergo other needed care, including surgery. In general, it costs more to leave gum disease untreated than it would be to treat it. Advocates have numerous studies from health insurance companies showing that treatment of gum disease actually reduces overall medical costs for patients with a number of other chronic health issues, such as heart disease, diabetes, and dementia. We are happy to share those studies with interested committee members if folks would like. Because we are not covering the treatment of gum disease right now, dental and medical costs increase, and Minnesotans are not getting the care they need. And with me today, Madam Chair and committee members, I do have Dr. Catherine Sievert with Community Dental Care, which is a large safety net provider of dental services both in the Twin Cities and Rochester. Also in your packet, committee members, are letters of support from Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association, the Minnesota Dental Association, and the Help Minnesota Smile campaign. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lean. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi. My name is Dr. Catherine Sievert.
All right. Dr. Sievert, please go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. I'm Dr. Catherine Sievert. I'm the dental director at Community Dental Care. I also represent, I'm speaking on behalf of the Dental Access Partners, which includes Appletree Dental, Hennepin Healthcare, and Community Dental Care. So we are not-for-profit safety net dental providers. The vast majority of our patients are on public programs. We serve patients in 85 out of 87 counties in Minnesota. Over 80% of our patients are enrolled in public programs. And we see patients in our 13 clinics, as well as over 175 community sites, including schools, nursing homes, and other locations. As Representative Lane did explain very well, there are two dental diseases. They both are bacterial. The first causes cavities. You're probably very familiar with that. The second is the gum disease or periodontal disease. This is an infection caused by bacteria. And as the body tries to fight off this infection in the gums, it actually causes an inflammation response that gets a little bit out of control. And so the body, the inflammation destroys the supporting structures around the tooth, which is mostly the bone. So you lose bone around the tooth, which can lead to pain, like an acute infection, and overall bone loss of the teeth, which can which can make the teeth be lost, become loose, and then fall out or need to be removed. Treatment for this disease is not covered by medical assistance, and thousands of Minnesotans suffer from this disease. The surface area affected by this disease has been approximated to be about the size of your palm. If you can imagine, if there was an infection, a skin infection that was this size, it would cause someone to find medical treatment immediately. So if you can imagine, it should be really no surprise that untreated periodontal disease have been linked to systemic diseases, including diabetes, heart disease, lung infections, and even preterm birth. My favorite studies about this link show that diabetic patients have better control over their blood sugar levels when their periodontal diseases have been treated. So this bill would correct that problem. It would add the benefit of something called scaling and rip planing, which is a deep cleaning. This is the simplest and most effective way to treat periodontal disease. The goal of this cleaning is actually to bring the patient back to health. Some people only needed to have it one time in their lifetime. Some people need to, if they have other comorbidity diagnoses, sometimes they need to have it done more than one time in their lives. So untreated dental disease can affect serious health conditions and cause that cost more than dental care does. I've been told that numerous analyses show that patients with common chronic conditions who receive dental periodontal services have significantly lower overall medical health care costs. So based on last year's fiscal notes, there was a projected net savings to the state approaching $500,000 each year just for diabetics, which is over and above the total costs of restoring periodontal benefits. So in closing, I would encourage all of you to support this bill, HF 840. There is broad consensus and strong support from dental groups, including the Minnesota Dental Association, Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association, the Board of Dentistry, and many other groups, because we all know that it will improve overall health, reduce disparities, and help to drive down overall health costs. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I welcome your questions.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I remember back when we had to cut the budget, and it was really hard. And I remember in this committee, people were really trying to scramble to find ways to cut the budget that would least hurt people. And unfortunately, when we have to do that, it does hurt people. And then it takes sometimes, as we see now, many, many years to get back even to where we were. So thank you very much for your testimony. Question, Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this this bill. I had an aunt, actually, that had terrible dental issues, and she had bacterial infections and issues that eventually caused her to have heart issues and heart failure, and they attributed her early death to this. So it is really important that we are addressing dental health in a very full way of our health. But I'm wondering, why is this, why are non-pregnant adults, why is it limited to non-pregnant adults?
I think that was when the
Dr. Seeger.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, thank you. I think when they cut the bill or cut the funding for this a number of years ago, a little over 10 years ago, I think. That's just what they chose to cut that for non-pregnant adults. So there are additional benefits for children and for women who are pregnant, and that does include scaling and cleaning.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. That might have been a recognition that it was going to have health impacts, and it was trying to, you know, protect some of the most vulnerable, perhaps. Yeah, yeah. Are there other questions for members? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much. I you know, personally think this is a really important thing to do, and we'll see if we're able to do it this year. I'm not sure what the budget's going to be, but with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
All right, we're going to call now House File 963, Representative Halverson. And Representative Halverson is going to move 963 to be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. And you have an A3 amendment?
That is correct, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A3 amendment. Mm-hmm. It's an author's amendment creates some technical changes and some updates based on what happened in statute last session.
All right. So Representative Halverson moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the order in which she would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. So Representative Halverson, the bill is in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Many of you heard this bill last year. It was went through the committee process and was laid over for possible inclusion and was in the House's omnibus bill, but it didn't make it through to the final product. So I'm very pleased to bring this bill back before our committee. House File 963 is a bill that is going to protect and expand access to contraception in Minnesota. Since this committee gave the bill a full hearing last year and it was included in the omnibus bill, I'm not going to go into great detail, but I'm happy to answer any questions. What we know is that contraception, birth control, is essential to the health and well-being of Minnesotans. Nearly 9 of 10 women of reproductive age will use birth control at some point in their lives, many of them for reasons beyond planning pregnancy. To ensure that Minnesotans can plan their families and their futures by accessing birth control and by accessing the method that is right for them, regardless of the cost and free of unnecessary insurance barriers, House File 963 does two things. It puts the ACA requirement that insurance plans cover FDA-approved categories of contraception at no out-of-pocket cost into our state law. And second, it allows Minnesotans to receive up to a 12-month supply of birth control at a time covered by insurance. Now, let's be clear. The ACA requirement is currently in place. This is something that all Minnesotans have access to at this point. And what is important about this bill is that with the risks that we're seeing and the challenges to the ACA that we're seeing, we do not want to see Minnesotans' health care be contracted. We want to be able to be sure that we are providing the health care that Minnesotans have come to rely on and expect to keep them healthy. At least 11 states in this country have already codified ACA birth control rules into state law, and 19 have enacted laws that allow patients to receive an extended supply of birth control at once. With the ACA at risk, the Supreme Court is set to hear arguments on a federal rule that would allow any employer to remove contraception coverage from their employees' insurance plans. And the ACA in general is going to be heard in a Supreme Court challenge. The time is now to pass this bill and make sure that we are not going to allow Minnesotans to have their health care coverage interrupted. Birth control is basic health care. Millions of Minnesotans, including thousands of our constituents and members of our own families, and many of us in this room today, rely on birth control to plan and space pregnancies, to control underlying health conditions, and to attend college and progress in our jobs. I urge you to join me in supporting this common sense bill that will help to protect and expand access to contraception in Minnesota. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier that would like to speak to the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
My name is Dr. Siri Fiebiger. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Siri Fiebiger, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Minnesota Section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And we represent nearly 1,000 providers of women's health care here in Minnesota. And we strongly support House File 963. Representative Halverson has clearly outlined the benefits, the broad benefits of contraception access. So let me tell you about the urgency. Access to contraception can literally be the difference between life and death for a woman. In the U.S., it's more dangerous now to have a baby than it was a generation ago. And the maternal mortality rate is rising, unlike any other country, developed country. Here in the United States, it's up to 24 deaths per 100,000 live births. In Minnesota, we're a little better at 14 per 100,000, but we're still twice what Canada's is at 7 per 100,000. Women of childbearing age are getting sicker and at younger ages for reasons that are not entirely clear. Women of color or indigenous women Their risk of death is 3 times that of white women, regardless of their education or their socioeconomic status. And my patients know this, and they tell me these numbers. So contraception access means women can choose if and when to take on this very real risk of pregnancy. Access to the right contraception works. Since the Affordable Care Act was enacted, improved access to contraception without cost sharing has dropped the unintended pregnancy rate from 48% to 36% here in Minnesota, an improvement seen across all age groups. Women no longer have to spend hundreds of dollars a year on birth control pills or up to $1,000 a year or $1,000 on an IUD. They no longer have to settle for that affordable one with intolerable bad side effects. Access to contraception means a woman can optimize her health and determine the right space between pregnancies for her. Planned pregnancies result in healthier outcomes for mom and baby, full-term deliveries, healthy birth weights, high-quality prenatal care, optimizing outcomes for complicated pregnancies. With the ACA guarantees being threatened, the security for for Minnesota's women that is provided by House File 963 becomes even more vital for their personal well-being and that of their families and our community. Every woman, regardless of her insurer, her employer, or her income, should have easy, affordable access to the right contraception for her at the right time. Their lives depend on it. Thank you for the opportunity and welcome any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fiebiger. We have a question from a member, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Halverson, I have a question on your, I guess, on the amendment that was adopted on lines 2.30 and 2.31, and then maybe it references in your fiscal note on page 7. So it says medical assistance coverage for a prescription contraceptive must provide a 12-month supply for any prescription contraceptive. The fiscal note on page 7, on right above assumptions, it says that plans must provide for a 12-month supply for any prescription contraceptive regardless of whether the enrollee was covered by the health plan at the time of first dispensing. Does that mean that someone can be given a prescription for a 12-month supply for a contraceptive and then their insurance is no longer valid, and a month later the insurance plan would be forced to pay for the 12-month supply even though they're no longer a covered insured?
Representative Halverson. Madam Chair, the note on the fiscal note makes some assumptions, and I think what I heard Representative Munson and Mr. Berg can correct me if I'm wrong, but what I heard you say is that if somebody is not currently covered but then gets covered, they can get their 12-month supply, that it's not that they get their 12-month supply and drop coverage. I see Mr. Berg nodding. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson and Halverson, first, there's a slight disconnect because the language of Representative Halverson's amendment is this year's language. This fiscal note was drafted last year, and I saw no need to change it because if you look at the assumptions that are in there, it makes an assumption that people are covered as they were and as they are now in this bill for up to 12 months. But if you note in there, it permits a prescriber to prescribe less than 12 months. So it isn't, I think the situation you're saying doesn't occur, I believe. I could be proven wrong on that. But so then it's making an assumption that nobody is getting more, there isn't more utilization of the drug than there would have been anyway in MA, so there's no drug cost. At which point the only cost is a $4,000 systems change to say you can have up to a 12-month prescription.
Representative Munson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Berg. I guess if someone who has private insurance loses their job, they get medical assistance for 2 months, and during that period of time, they get a prescription for birth control, and then they subsequently get private insurance again. When they fill their prescription, is medical assistance, because it says that they
regardless of whether the enrollee was covered by the health plan at the time of first dispensing, does that mean that the insurance plan, when they get their prescription filled, I mean that the previous plan would pay for it or some?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I think it's the opposite of what you're saying. Medical assistance will not pay out for a period in which you are not eligible for medical assistance. So if you had a prescription from a private insurer and lose your job and go on medical assistance, I think what it says is the prescription is still valid and MA, then you're MA eligible, so it's covered. If in the other circumstance you're on MA and you get a job and you're covered on private insurance, you're no longer MA eligible. So MA won't pay.
Okay.
All right. One more, Representative Munson.
So the fiscal note, that section two is still valid with the amendment that we adopted today. Is that correct?
Mr. Burke.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, that's my understanding. You could verify. I've talked to both the sponsors of the language and the department, but not today. The language was massaged just slightly. So.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Halverson, I was looking at the amendment also on 3.1 to 3.5, and then on page 5 of the bill, Section 2, coverage for prescription contraceptive supply requirements. I see there is an exemption for contraceptives that not include emergency contraceptive drug that prevents pregnancy when administered after sexual contact. Does your bill allow abortifacients to be covered as prescription contraceptives?
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Halverson.
Representative Grunhagen, birth control does not cause abortion.
And maybe, you know, since you have an OBGYN doctor sitting next to you, maybe you could ask her to comment on that as well. Dr. Fiebiger, if you would.
I'd be happy to. Contraception does not cause abortion.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. Could I just have a clarifying question?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, I'm just going for my wife, okay? And the thing is that when her doctor talked to her about it, this was a few years ago, obviously, but there was where the egg and the sperm were, that conception did take place, but it prevented it from being implanted in the universe. And that was an abortifacient, is my understanding.
Dr. Fiebiger?
So, in terms of what happens at fertilization, so fertilization and conception are two different things. So eggs are fertilized, and one out of six or seven does actually implant. But six out of seven do not. I mean, that's just normal physiology. And so to assume that any and all fertilized eggs are going to implant regardless of the environment is fallacious.
And Representative Halverson.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up, I think it's really important to highlight what the doctor testified to, and that is because we have had these policies in place in Minnesota under the ACA, we have had a decrease of unplanned pregnancies of 12%. And having worked in public health for a very long time, getting a 12% change on anything is a huge deal. It really shows that public policy is working. And so that's why this bill is very important.
Thank you. And I also wanted to ask Dr. Fiebiger, do you have an opinion about whether having this kind of access to birth control actually reduces abortions? Or do you have any, I don't know if you have evidence or can observe such a thing, but if you can, I'd like to hear about it.
Well, there is data showing that the drop in unintended pregnancy rate has also seen a drop in abortion rates among all age groups, and particularly in Minnesota. So, yes, up to 68% drop.
Okay, thank you. I mean, it just seems to make sense, right? If you don't want to have a baby and you can avoid getting pregnant, then you don't end up having an abortion. It just makes a lot of sense. And of course, some people who have unintended pregnancies go on to carry the pregnancy to term, but of course, one way to prevent abortion would seem to be to allow women to control their reproduction in the first place, right? That's kind of what we all profess to want, I think, is that women not to have to face the choice of whether to have an abortion.
Madam Chair, I just got one question.
And Dr. Fiebiger, I thought you wanted to say something further, and then I'll call on Representative Grunhagen.
I think it's important for us here in the United States to understand that we still have the highest unplanned pregnancy rate among developed countries. The next lowest is France at 30%. So we still have an access issue. We still have, and we don't want to lose ground in that respect. And so I just would like to give that kind of context to the conversation today.
All right, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, is this, Representative Halverson, is this bill supported by Planned Parenthood?
Representative Halverson.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, there is a large coalition that is in support of this bill and who support access to health care, and Planned Parenthood is one of the supporters. So are a number of physician groups.
Thank you. Speaking of physicians and physician groups, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about lines 4.8 to 4.17, where there's religious exemption by an employer. So, I mean, we're saying here that an employer who knows nothing about my health and who knows nothing about me or why I choose the health care that I choose gets to choose what I use for my own health care and gets to impose their religion on my health. So aside from my disdain for that entire section, is there some kind of metric for an employer to say I am religiously opposed to this, or can anyone say that?
Representative Halverson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mann, I certainly understand your frustration and your assertion that your personal medical decisions aren't the business of your employer or anybody else probably in your life, but with regard to case law and current ACA statute, this is consistent with what currently exists. And so, yes, there are parameters that an employer can have a closely held religious objection and be exempt. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, seeing no further discussion, I think we're ready to vote on the bill. So Representative Halverson renews her motion that House File 963 as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
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 The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you very much. All right. Okay, we're going to go to Representative Cantrell, House File 1523. Cantrell is going to move House File 1523 to be re-referred to Ways and Means.
That is correct, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
And you have a DE3. Oh, no. Do you have an amendment? Let's see. Okay. You have an amendment in the package, the DE32. Did you want to move that right now?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move the amendment.
All right. Representative Cantrell moves the DE3-2 to get the bill in the order in which he'd like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. So the bill is before us as amended, and go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's an honor to present House File 1523 before you today. This is a really kind of exciting bill, in my opinion, because it combines a few elements that I think a lot of people around this table really care a lot about, and that is efficient spending in government, making sure people are able to get health care, and overall taking a look at how we can implement an infrastructure through which we can successfully reduce the cost of pharmaceuticals. So just kind of as an overview, House File 1523 removes the pharmacy benefit managers from the administration of our of the pharmacy benefits for our public health programs. What this bill also does is it directs the commissioner of the Department of Human Services to, after 1 year, evaluate and assemble a plan that would allow for private insurers then to contract with the state to administer patient benefit or the patient prescription drug benefits for the private insurance market as well, if they so choose. So it's completely optional. Adds an element of competition into the market. It adds a significant element of, I think, transparency in efficiency when we're especially talking about taxpayer dollars. We want to make sure that they're not wasted. We currently have a system in which our fee-for-service medical assistance population already has their prescription drug benefits administered by the department, whereas the remainder of our medical assistance population and all of our Minnesota Care population has their pharmacy benefits administered along with the rest of their health benefits through managed care organizations, which all use pharmacy benefit managers in order to evaluate and implement those pharmacy benefits. Now, one of the reasons why we're looking at this approach is that a few other states have moved in this direction recently. North Dakota, West Virginia. It kind of reflects what President Trump has talked about in terms of allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. It's not a one-for-one, but it kind of implements the same idea that if we're talking about in the administration of our public health benefits, that we should be able to have the negotiating and purchasing leveraging or purchase leveraging power of our covered patients on those programs. One of the other elements of this bill that I wanted to kind of really emphasize is that under our current structure, as we have a good portion of about the 1.5 million Minnesotans who are on either medical assistance or Minnesota Care, having their benefits administered through managed care organizations, we, and then by extension by the pharmacy benefit managers, we need to evaluate, as we have kind of discussed heavily throughout the course of the proceedings of this committee, whether or not we think that the money that is being spent and that we're told, hey, this is what it costs to administer these benefits, is the most appropriate kind of allocation of that money when we can do the job for, as you'll see in the fiscal note, significantly cheaper. It's about $25 million cheaper than is currently being administered through pharmacy benefit managers, because that money, when it moves away from the state and to these non-public entities, is no longer accountable, right? And it also goes to other purposes other than solely the administration of benefits, because these private entities, they have senior executives to pay, they have high administration costs, they have any number of kind of extenuating cost factors that just are not present in the structure that is currently used as by the state and administering the fee-for-service medical assistance benefits. So that's kind of an overview of the bill and a little bit of the rationale for why I think that this is a good move, not only in terms of making sure that we use taxpayer dollars efficiently, but after a year, after it's implemented, or hopefully implemented, if this bill becomes law, then we will have a good kind of proof of concept, as kind of other states are starting to see, and be able to really kind of extend those benefits of this approach of leveraging the bulk purchasing power of the state and of at least over a million covered lives in securing, finally, more affordable pharmaceuticals in the state of Minnesota. So with that, I think I'll turn to my testifier, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Mary Turner. I am the president of Minnesota Nurses Association, but more importantly, I'm also a night shift medical surgical ICU nurse at North Morrell in Robbinsdale. M&A represents about 22,000 bedside care nurses who live and work in Minnesota, parts of Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Iowa. And I'm here to speak in support of House File 1523. At MNA, we believe that not only health care is a human right, but that it's a foundation for a thriving community. For nurses, it's why we care for patients beyond the bedside. In hospitals all over the states, nurses see the devastating consequences of expensive prescription drugs being out of reach for too many patients who end up in the emergency room and in the ICUs because they're rationing their necessary medication and they're forced to settle for the best drug to treat their condition, but not for the best one that treats their condition, but rather for the one that is the cheapest option. At this point, I'd like to reflect on just what happened, an incident that happened last week where I was at my local grocery store and I was at the pharmacy counter and I was standing by on the person who was checking out. And this elderly gentleman was picking up meds for his wife. And the pharmacy tech says to him, "Sir, that'll be $550. And I remember thinking, I remember having two thoughts. First of all, if I'm spending $550 at a grocery store, I better have a trunk full of groceries with a bag full of porterhouse steaks in it. My second thought, though, led me to start thinking of the fact that $550 for a small bag of prescription, this is what this gentleman was paying out of pocket. And I did some further study then as to some of the average costs that my patients in my medical ICU run into. So I looked up like what the average cost monthly of, say, you have a cardiac condition. People can spend anywhere from $220 to $541 a month just on their cardiac meds. If they have COPD or some kind of respiratory condition, they can spend up to, like for three inhalers, $815 a month just for their inhalers. Those costs for drugs like an inhaler called Spiriva can be anywhere from $484 up to $1,435, depending if you get 30 capsules or 90. Okay, this is all out of pocket that people can spend. Seizure disorders. Those drugs range anywhere from $7.88 a month to up to $3,110. Now, all of these conditions, I should point out that, especially like the seizure, the cardiac, et cetera, oftentimes you're on multiple meds. My own sister has a seizure disorder, and she's on five different seizure meds because you need to have different meds to control different types of seizures. Then I got to thinking how in the nursing profession, at least, and I don't know if people in the medical profession remember that we used to have patients that would come in, they'd have an exacerbation of their respiratory condition or they'd have a seizure. And every once in a while you kind of dig into it and you find that these people weren't taking their meds. And we would, whether it was right or wrong, we would kind of label these people as non-compliant. They were a non-compliant patient. You know, they kept coming back. Well, listening to this gentleman having to pay that at the counter and then knowing how much drugs cost, and now what I'm seeing, I'm rethinking this going, is it really non-compliance because they're being a bad patient? Or is it because they can't afford their meds and they would dearly love to avoid an ICU stay? And then I take it one step further. This past weekend, I had a COPD. She had a respiratory crisis exacerbation. And I watched that patient thrashing in the bed, totally air hungry, totally beside herself, and how many it took to help control and calm down this person. And I also remember the seizure person that had nonstop seizures that it didn't stop until they were intubated. And I got to thinking, these people don't not want to take their meds. It's very possible that they couldn't afford them, and this is not where they wanted to end up, was in the ICU, in these extreme conditions of their disease process. And so it changed the whole cultural way of how I'm thinking of how my patients are. You know what I'm saying? And need I remind you, and I've said this to the committee before, not too long ago, where I said, and I've looked it up recently, North Memorial ICU, which is very average. We're not the most expensive hospital. We're not the least expensive. We're middle of the road. And right now, it costs $11,000 a night in the ICU just for the bed, excluding all medications, the emergency room, the ambulance, and all that. $11,000 a night. This is not the most efficient way to handle health care by managing it in our intensive cares. And one other thing I'd like to point out is that not too long ago I talked to our CEO, and he kind of quoted something, well, you know, Mary, the way of the future is mega ICUs and then everything else in home care. Actually, I wasn't surprised by this because I read this statistic way back in 2012 in the Institute of Medicine report, the IOM report, that this is what they predicted for the future. And once again, as I see evidence of this, this is not the way to manage care.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Turner. We have a couple of questions. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And congratulations, Representative Cantrell. You have actually written a proposed legislation that creates a PBM that's run by government. This is actually, if you wanted to write a legislation to create a PBM, this is exactly what this does. We know that PBMs are part of the problem of high cost of drugs, and Representative Grunhagen and Hamilton would agree as well. But if I was to write rules to create a PBM run by government, it would probably be about 100 pages long because we know a long list of the problems why more expensive drugs are given preference to the list, and all these rebates and stuff that are causing problems and raising the cost of drugs. On line 1.11 of your bill, where you say you want to make prescription drugs available at the lowest possible cost, that still allows them to make a $1,000 a month drug $800 as opposed to the $100 generic equivalent. And that's one of the problems we have with PBMs, is that the rebates, because they manage the formulary, they put more expensive drugs higher on the list in the preference versus the cheaper generic alternative. So just, you know, rewriting the sentence to say making the lowest cost prescription drugs available to program participants would change the direction that you're giving to this new agency that you're creating. On line 1.14, you use the words most effective prescription drugs. This is where you really start to feel the lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry to try to show you that these drugs are more effective and therefore should be given preference on the list. On line 1.22, you say that you want to adopt and develop this preferred drug list, and you actually even mention on line 2.2, this new PBM that you're creating receiving rebates. Now, this is rebates from the manufacturers. These are the rebates that we talk about all the time rebates for drugs that are paid, you know, half by the federal government, but the rebates could go right to the, you know, commissioner in the Commissioner of Human Services and their agency, and not actually, you know, driving down the cost for taxpayers directly. I think this bill has a lot of work that would need to be done to actually put the necessary guardrails in place for this. And if this isn't even enough, on line 2.5, you say the commissioner may contract with one or more entities to perform any of the functions described in paragraph A, which is creating this entire entity. So you could do this, have the commissioner of health create this agency, and then basically contract to existing PBMs to perform all the work, because we're not set up to do all of the fulfilling of the prescriptions in services, but sounds like you may end up even contracting with the PBM to do the work. So I don't see anything in this bill that says you're giving preference to generics or biosimilars, working to actually choose the cheapest drug and always using the cheaper alternative. And then, of course, just removing rebates from the program altogether, because that is something that was going to basically duplicate the PBMs we have today. So that's kind of my question, and how do you see this not duplicating PBMs?
All right, so Representative Cantrell, I'm going to let you answer, but also I think Mr. Hope is here if you want him to come up as well, but please, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Munson, for several sentences that I think together formed a question of some variety. So I'm going to start by saying, first of all, I agree. You know, if I was going to create a PBM in government, yeah, it would be 100 pages long, but there's a reason why it's not, because we are not creating a PBM in government. There is no new agency being created here. As I said in my opening testimony, Madam Chair, Representative Munson, this is actually just what the Department of Human Services is already doing for our fee-for-service MA population. So it's something that's already being implemented. It's you said, oh, well, what are they doing with the rebates? Where do you think they go now, Representative Munson? I haven't heard you raise any questions about where the rebates go right now for our fee-for-service MA population that DHS is administering the benefits for prior to this hearing. So I'm assuming that I think that you are a quite studious person. Had there been anything untoward, you probably would have brought it up at this point during these long conversations that we've had about the functions of government and PBMs. More so, I think that one of the essential portions of this bill is that unlike an actual PBM, the way that the state government conducts the administration of our public pharmacy benefits, as it is already doing for our fee-for-service MA population, is not only efficient, but it's also accountable to the public, whereas PBMs are not. So I have a difficult time empathizing with your viewpoint on this, that you think that we are establishing something new, because that is not correct, or that we are establishing something that heretofore has not been vetted and tested already in Minnesota. It has, and it's been proven actually to be more efficient than for our managed care MA and MinCare populations, in that over a four-year period of time, the cost of administering the health benefits for our fee-for-service MA population remain relatively flat, whereas the cost of administering those same or those benefits for our managed care MA population and MinCare managed care population rose about 21%, largely because of drug costs. And that is because PBMs are not transparent, they are not accountable to the people, and when they have an opportunity to squeeze more money out of taxpayers, they're going to try to do it, whereas we actually do have oversight over DHS. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and if I could just, Representative Cantrell, I think that the question about what happens to rebates, if we get rebates, if the state gets rebates, my understanding, you know, we've had this discussion before, members don't always understand how this works, but when we cut expenses in our forecasted programs, in our programs like MA, which this would be included under, the savings drops to the bottom line. So, you know, in other words, when we get the so-called surplus, that includes whatever money was expected to be spent, but now less is expected to be spent. And in fact, recently a lot of our surplus has been savings in MA. So sometimes members don't understand this because we think, oh, it stays in some kind of a fund and then they can use it at DHS for something else. That, in fact, is not the case. But I'm going to ask Mr. Berg, our nonpartisan fiscal staff, to, if I'm wrong, let me know. But please, you know, if you can add to that.
Madam Chair, members, no, as I heard it, you're basically correct. I mean, the state gets a very sizable amount of rebates through the MA and Minnesota Care programs. In both fee-for-service and managed care, the rebates come to the state and act as an offset to our costs in those programs, bringing them down, and then thus the whatever we don't spend goes to the bottom line.
Right, and thank you, Mr. Bergen. The corollary to that, though, as I understand this, what Representative Cantrell's bill is doing is right now when we pay the capitated rate to the HMOs, and that includes the drug program, and they're administering it, when there are rebates within that, because they each hire a PBM, they do the rebate thing, those rebates stay within those HMOs. They don't fall to our bottom line. So the taxpayer is not getting the benefit of those.
No, we get it for managed care.
We do, okay.
Yep,
well, we don't have, so, okay. We don't have the kind of control over this that we do if we do it, if we pull it out. And this part of this, the trend idea that we can see that the costs are going up much faster under the managed care program than they are under fee-for-service, even though fee-for-service, as a general rule, has more complex patients in it than the general medical, PMAP patients, the ones under managed care. So, that's why this is viewed and why the fiscal note shows a cost savings for this, because of the, you know, so even if we get we, in theory, get the rebates from what's being negotiated by the HMOs. Is that what I'm understanding, that they come back to the state? I thought they were kind of baked
Chair,
into the...
Madam Chair, we get pharmacy rebates for both fee-for-service and managed care in MA. You would need maybe somebody from DHS to comment more directly on how the managed care rebate is tracked, how they know what that number is.
Mr. Hope is going to come down and explain that, because I think this is pretty critical to the bill and what Representative Cantrell is trying to do here. So we need to understand, why we save money on this. And even, we've got the big bad PBMs, but are they less bad if we do it this way as opposed to the way it's currently done? Mr. Hope, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chad Hope. I'm the Pharmacy Program Manager and Deputy Director for Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS. I'll admit there's a lot of questions that I think are floating around. The one that I can address directly is about the rebates for the managed care organizations. It is true we get the federal Medicaid drug rebate on managed care claims. Those are currently invoiced by DHS and collected by DHS. We then share that rebate with the federal government based on the funding percentages. There are also rebates that the PBMs working with the MCOs are able to negotiate and collect. Those are also reported back to DHS, and we use that in the rate setting. But what we don't know is, are they reported to us in their entirety? They could be, or maybe a portion is not. There's just not a lot of transparency there. And that is some of what this conversation may be focused on, is those additional rebates, not the federal Medicaid drug rebate.
Okay, so Representative Monson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'm just focused on the rebates that come back from the pharmaceutical industry because of trying to get preference for putting, name brand drugs on the higher on the formulary than generics. But can you explain to me good rebates that, we're not just talking about rebates on a $1,000 drug that discounts at $200 versus a, $100 generic equivalent, but can you tell me where there's good rebates that would actually, in the long run, save the state and taxpayers money for the most effective drug, not just one that has the highest rebate?
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair, Representative, so there's actually a very interesting provision in federal law under Section 1927 of the Social Security Act. It's a federal gag clause on state Medicaid agencies from talking about rebates on individual drugs. I actually can't tell you drug prices or individual rebates. I can give you aggregate information, but strangely enough, they have that provision. You are correct. There are some drugs that have very significant rebates and some drugs that just have the minimum mandatory federal rebate. But unfortunately, I can't disclose those.
Okay. And you know what? Just so everyone knows, so we have three more members with questions, Schumacher, Grunhagen, Hamilton. So can I go to Representative Schumacher? All right. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask about the rebates, but I'm a little too confused to even form a question at the moment for that. I do have a couple of questions about the fiscal note itself. And I'll just kind of list these out, the questions here. The $30 million, that's the buyback that's mentioned on the first page and a couple of other times in the fiscal note, if you could explain some of that. The buy-down piece that's on page 5 are the leverage piece for the 340B. I can't remember who is the program administrator, who gets the reimbursement rates for the 340B that the state's going to be leveraging on, and if you could help me out with that. And then finally, you're referring to some of the things that the state's already doing with this, if I could just get a little bit of an update on just where the state's at with their preferred drug list and how that's operating and what is being done now. I see about halfway through the page on page 5 that DHS already is contracting with third-party entity to conduct prior authorization and that sort of thing. So if I could get an update on those to help understand this a little bit better, that would be appreciated. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. So I don't know if, Mr. Berg could do some of it, maybe, and Mr. Hope could probably.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, the very first thing maybe I'll address, which is the end of the buyback of the managed care withhold, and then I'll maybe throw the 340B stuff to Mr. Hope. In the case of managed care contracts by state law, we withhold a month's payment, basically. We pay them a month later, and so out of any 12-month period, we're paying 12 months worth, but in a from a fiscal year basis, you pay 11 months of one fiscal year, and then you pay the 12th month in the next one. And for the portion of the managed care contracts attributable to pharmacy, that musical chairs game, the music will stop on January 1st of 2023. And then so the July payment will clean up that and pay the $30 million that's being withheld, or estimated $30 million that's relative to the pharmacy portion of the managed care contracts. But there won't be another one in that end of that next year coming in where we're delaying it so that it, you see what I'm saying? That there's a cleanup payment to do the last one, which falls in July of 23, so that's the first month of fiscal 23. That's why that's there. 340.
Okay, Mr. Hope, did you get that second question? Maybe you can address that.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative, and please let me know if I'm not addressing it properly. The information regarding the 340B reimbursement, so last year as part of the big omnibus, we had a covered outpatient drug rule cleanup that dated back to the 2016 federal covered outpatient drug rule, which required fee-for-service to pay 340B at no more than either the ceiling price or the actual acquisition cost of the 340B providers. So one of the revisions that was made as part of that is we paid the ceiling cost price, which is, once again, unfortunately, part of that confidential calculation. But it essentially pays a discounted rate to the 340B providers for their drugs because they're able to purchase it at a lower rate. And then the state realizes the savings through the reduced payment. That reduced payment occurs because we don't get the federal Medicaid drug rebate on those claims. They're ineligible due to the 340B program laws. So the reduced reimbursement to the providers reflects that lost rebate. So if this bill were to move the population to fee-for-service from managed care, we would use our reimbursement structure, whereas historically the managed care organizations, PBMs, don't have necessarily that same calculation because they don't have access to this, the components you would need to estimate the ceiling price. So we would be able to reimburse those claims at a more efficient rate.
Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair, so just to clarify, the people that you would be leveraging now with the new population, those are, you said the providers, so this would be like hospitals and clinics and those sorts that we're leveraging on for the savings?
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair, Representative, so the 340B covered entities would receive the lower reimbursement rate. So that would be, there are some hospital-based systems, and it wouldn't be the contract pharmacies. That's a separate, more confusing game altogether, but it'd be the 340B providers, correct.
Thank you.
Okay, and was there a third part of that, Representative Schumacher? Did we hit everything?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a third part there. Just an update on where the state is at with the preferred drug list and how that administration is going right now, how things are working.
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair, Representative, so the preferred drug list, we actually had a drug formulary committee meeting last night. We have not had complaints or feedback from the community that things are going anything other than fine. We keep in pretty close communication with Pharmacy Association and the various provider groups. Best we can tell, things are going well. Members are having their benefit more aligned across the MCOs and fee-for-service program. The implementation went fairly smoothly, and we're looking forward to getting a little bit further down the road so that we can start assessing the impact on the claims, because it just takes a while for it to roll in according to how the rebate program works. It's always a retrospective review. So I don't have any data on that. But as far as the administration and impact on members and providers, it seems to be going well.
All right. Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anybody, if something happens to you, is there anybody else that understands this?
That's a really good question.
Amen.
Everybody caught that, right?
You better keep the tape, I tell you that. No, Madam Chair.
Representative Greenhill.
On a serious note, quite a few of my concerns have been asked already, but I would just say, you know, the premise here is that more government is going to create better outcomes. I got a hard time swallowing that, okay? And, of course, you've heard me on the House floor, so I won't repeat all that. But, you know, to me, this is just one more brick in the wall of single payer and government. And when I look at the history of government involvement in healthcare, like I said before, 99 times out of 100, you get shortages, more convoluted, more complexity, and less access for patients to the things that they really need. And we all have concerns about PBM. Everybody wants patients to get the drugs that they need at a reasonable cost. But I don't think moving this direction will produce this type of outcome. With that, I'll pass on any questions you go to.
All right, thanks, Representative Greenhagen. You know, I guess I would just say this isn't more government. You know, these are public programs. These are taxpayer-paid programs. And the point is that the way we've organized it now, running it through these private entities and having each of these HMOs hire their own PBM to do whatever they're doing, we've made it a lot less efficient. We are wasting public money. That, I think, is the point of this bill, that we can do better with our public funds for our public programs. This is not growing government. This is making government do more efficiently what it is already supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I agree with you that the current system needs to be reformed. I just don't think this is the right direction.
Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. PBMs had their chance, and they failed miserably. I've been screaming about this a long time, many, many years. And I personally believe if we had eliminated PBMs, we'd decrease costs and we'd increase care. My message back to the PBMs is when you have multiple states targeting you directly, you may want to rethink your business model. Thank you for bringing this forward. You have my support. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. You continue to be our voice of conscience on these issues. Thank you. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. This is a wonderful bill. I wish it was mine. It's that good. A quick side note, Representative Greenhagen, and to anybody else, this disdain for universal health care and single payer, I don't understand it, just simply because every other country of similar wealth in the world has some form of universal health care, and the vast majority of them have better health care outcomes than we do at a fraction of the cost. Better health care outcomes. So I think the idea that it's horrible, we need to really rethink. Side note. But back to the bill. We know that it works. We know that removing PBM works. Again, West Virginia did it. They expected to save $28 million. They saved $34 million right after they removed their PBMs. And it's a $10 billion industry. So you think that once upon a time they had a role in decreasing drug costs, but now when they pocket $10 billion, where do you think that money is coming from? So again, thank you, Representative Cantrell. We know it works, so I'm very happy you brought this forward.
All right, so thank you. So Representative Cantrell renews his motion that House File 1523, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and thank you, Madam Chair, for all your work on this.
All right, thank you. We are going to take up now House File, 3450. And Representative Morrison is here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Morrison. The chair moves House File 3450, and it is to be laid over for possible inclusion. So the bill is before us. Let's see, was there an amendment on this one? I don't think there is. So with that, I think, Representative Morrison, I think we're ready to have you present your bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3450, which is a bill to increase the Family Planning Special Projects Grant Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. FPSP programs provide pre-pregnancy and family planning services to low-income, high-risk individuals. The services that are provided include breast and cervical cancer screenings, contraception, HIV testing, and other STD testing and treatment. Additional funding is needed because clinics are struggling to meet demand. In addition to needs outpacing funding, some clinics have lost funding the last year due to changes to the Title X family planning program at the federal level. Title X also supports pre-pregnancy and family planning services. The need is real. Minnesota is experiencing historically high rates of certain STDs, and FPSP funding supports clinics in addressing these outbreaks. According to MDH, the rate of chlamydia in 2017 increased 4%, and gonorrhea increased by 28%. Family planning is important for health and well-being, and it saves money. According to the Guttmacher Institute, the services provided at publicly funded family planning centers save the federal and state governments an estimated $13.6 billion in 2010. I do have a testifier here today. Alyssa Light is the board president of the Reproductive Health Alliance to further explain the need for this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alyssa Light. And as Representative Morrison said, I'm the board president of the Reproductive Health Alliance and also executive director of Family Tree Clinic. Thank you. Chair and committee members, the Reproductive Health Alliance is a statewide coalition for the reproductive health safety net across Minnesota. RHA's membership includes a variety of leading healthcare organizations, independent nonprofit community clinics, federally qualified healthcare centers, and advocacy organizations. Our over 70 clinic locations provide vital health care services to tens of thousands of low-income or uninsured people across Minnesota. Our member clinics range in service areas from the west side of St. Paul to North Minneapolis, Cambridge, Duluth, Worthington, and more. Minnesota is a national leader in health care, yet many people across our state experience tremendous barriers to basic preventive health care, particularly reproductive health care. Things like contraception, STI testing and treatment, annual exams, and breast and cervical cancer screenings are increasingly hard to access for Minnesotans. The Family Planning Special Projects Grant Program is an absolutely critical funding source for Minnesotans across our state. Administered by the Minnesota Department of Health, FPSP was put in place by the legislature in 1978. And since that time, these grant funds have been used to support access to family planning services around the state. Funds available through this family planning grant program are specifically targeted at individuals who face barriers, primarily due to factors like poverty. Having access to family planning services improves the health and well-being of all people across our state and saves our state and federal government an average of $7 for every $1 invested. Minnesota's family planning clinics are staffed by doctors, nurse practitioners, and nurses with expertise in their communities. Clinics have gone unfunded and underfunded, particularly clinics in greater Minnesota and clinics located in primarily communities of color. With the most recent impacts to Title X funding, we're looking at an increasingly serious situation impacting many healthcare access points around the state. In fact, Minnesota is in the midst of an STD epidemic, and we have significant disparities in teen and unplanned pregnancy. Last week, one of our member clinics shared this story with me, and I wanted to share it with all of you. They saw a patient for her routine pap and breast exam. It turned out she hadn't been to the doctor in over 10 years. She disclosed that she was experiencing intimate partner violence at home and that she was not safe to use her insurance. She had several health issues that needed to be addressed, and we were able to work with her, with case management staff, and with crisis response to help her get to a safe place after her visit. She trusted us because she said she felt seen, safe, and heard by the staff at our clinic. And she knew that this could be her moment to get support around the violence she was experiencing in her home. She also really needed medical care. And at the end of her visit, she said she felt like she was taking control of her life back. This kind of care is only possible with the Family Planning Special Projects Grant Program, period. We're reminded regularly right now that we are only as healthy as our most vulnerable community members. We have a powerful opportunity to do so much more with an investment in this healthcare need, in part because the infrastructure is already there, the programming is evidence-based and high-functioning, and the need is profound. We're grateful for the opportunity to request that you continue to say all Minnesotans' health and well-being is important and that no one should be left behind, and ask for your support of House File 3450. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right. Seeing none, and I don't have any questions here from members. Oh, yes, I do. Representative Halverson.
We're not going to have no questions. Actually, Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, but I wanted to elevate the story that was shared because I think it really underscores why need to support family planning grants, and that is family planning care is really whole person care and really essential care, and I think that that story illustrates just how important and essential that it is. For if we want to really care for the whole person, we need to make sure that we are including family planning, and it's an area of healthcare that we put up far too many barriers for people, either shame or money or judgment, whatever it may be, and we're talking about whole person care. So that's all I needed to say. Thank you for sharing that story.
All right. Thank you very much. Representative Grunhagen and then Bierman.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just in terms of, you know, again, we want access for patients. We just had a presentation a while back here in this committee. And according to that study by economists that was hired by the state, 1.2 million Minnesotans in 2017 did not access the health care they needed because of the high cost. And we can point right back to Obamacare on that, okay? So I think that's more of the problem than doctors at hospitals wanting to give the care that they need. So I just wanted to point that out. There's lots of stories you could tell about people not getting the health care they need, okay?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this forward. There are a lot of stories that we can talk about where people aren't getting the health care they need, and that's the job of this committee, to begin to move the ball on that and to figure out what is going to work better. Someday we're going to stop as our starting point of attacking Obamacare for all the problems of our health care system and realize the fact that Obamacare did some really, really, really positive things. In fact, we heard about the positive side in this committee. And what we didn't do with Obamacare was have the follow-up that we needed. Expanding this type of coverage, as Ms. Light spoke about, the needs that are there for the basic care for the whole person and for women in particular, I hope everybody's going to vote for this because that's the fundamental care. That's where it begins for the women and the mothers in our state of Minnesota. And my question is, if you would, what proportion of women in the state of Minnesota get the health care they need at this basic level of family planning?
Ms. White?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. We know that currently, at the very least, 40% of women across our state are going without access to the care that they need, particularly when looking at family planning access and clinics that are dedicated to providing family planning, but not only family planning clinics, primary care safety net as well.
Madam Chair, Ms. Light, thank you very much. So 40%, that's a big number. And we could make an impact right here, right now, today, to move health care forward for the state of Minnesota with cost savings. So thanks for bringing the bill forward, and I hope everybody will give this a yes vote.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Jordan.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this bill forward. I know that this bill has impacted people in this room because I was able to receive care when I turned 26 and was no longer able to use my parents' health insurance and had a gap in coverage. I was able to go to Family Tree Clinic, and Family Tree was able to work with me to take advantage of this grant to receive health care that I needed and receive screening for cervical cancer. So I first of all want to thank you for your work and thank you for expanding this so everyone can take advantage of programs like I did when I had this gap. And so my question is, to that end, as we're talking about that gap in the ACA, can you talk a little bit more about how this program would help people like myself who are in transition from finding care and making these transitions in life? Because that's where I really do see a great need for family planning. You know, when you're making a big transition, you've lost your job, you've lost your health insurance. That wasn't a time where I wanted to have a child by any means when I was making those decisions. So can you talk a little bit about how this grant really could help, you know, young women like myself and a lot of people in my community access these grants?
Ms. Light or Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, I just want to thank you, Representative, for sharing that personal story, because it really helps to bring to light the importance of this program. And I'm going to let Ms. Light take the...
Ms. Light.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Jordan. This grant program is intended to serve the need that you described exactly, as well as the need shared in this one story, which is just one of, you know, thousands of stories as to why someone might face barriers to family planning and basic primary care. Whether we expand health insurance coverage or utilize existing programs, there continue to be barriers to access, and these clinics are the front line for so many people to gain access and then also gain access to other services in these clinics like MNsure Navigators or assistance through our public assistance programs.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Q.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to point out that this isn't the only service that happens in Minnesota. There are a lot of women's health centers that help these young mothers and families. Sometimes young men that are in college or whatever they need, dealing with all kinds of issues that are health related, sometimes connected to pregnancy, but they're just not a one-stop place. They are a place where they can go back and get the help they need, connect with the services they need, and help them to emotionally get through something that might be challenging for them, whether it's an unplanned pregnancy or other health issues. In fact, quite a bit of it is, from what I understand, is STDs from both young men and young women, or people in general that come in. But there are a lot of these services. I believe there is some state dollars that goes toward that, but mostly they are fundraised. They are huge fundraisers and work with these young people or in general, and help families to become stable. There's fantastic stories out there about how there's been a crisis. But I want you to all know that it isn't just the government that does this. It isn't just the hospital and the clinic that does this. They direct them toward, there are doctors that run this. There's a lot of medical services. Usually nurses are quite heavily involved. And it is a really good program. And I can't tell you the hundreds of people I've heard from that this is what's turned their life around. The support they've gotten, not just from that one visit or that one family planning session or whatever. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Morrison, did you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your comment, Representative. I guess I would just say we can't rely just on philanthropy to cover these gaps. And so I think it's important that we have this program.
Okay, Ms. Light.
Madam Chair. The majority of the clinics who make up Reproductive Health Alliance receive family planning special projects grant program funding. They also bill insurance and Medicaid programs, and they also all fundraise. And the only way that we maintain this safety net and keep our doors open is by having a robust business model that's taking advantage of multiple sources of support. So this program is critical, and the clinics that it funds are profoundly connected in their communities for the support that's there as well. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I think we are, I don't see any other questions, and thank you very much. So actually, this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. So we're not actually voting on it today, but perhaps we will be at some time soon. So with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion, and thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member.
So, members, I just want to make a comment. In your packets, you have House Bill 3980, which is the bill for the COVID-19 that we heard at our last meeting. I'd like you to leave that, if you would. Leave it in your packet, because we're not going to hear that today. We put it in there in the hope that we would be ready with an amendment, but we're still working on that. So just to save copying and staff time, you could just put it back in your folders. That would be great. Under today would be fine, and we'll have that available when we're ready for that bill. So with that, thank you very much, everyone. We are adjourned.